From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
We don't generally have the same amount of energy that you need for the big storms that they get in the US.
I was wondering, yeah. Our storms are a bit lame, are they?
Business is in the hinge. All welcome to surfers and the campervanners who are an economic driver. So instead of complaining about it and putting up barriers, he should be looking for them to put up facilities.
There's a very special atmosphere in the happy out in Dunleary here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's different to anywhere you get anything you get anywhere else, yeah.
Coming up on this It's March All Over Again edition of Playback Daily. No country for storm chasers. Going abroad to photograph twisters. The ongoing campervan controversy in County Clare. And what makes Happy Out in Dunleary different? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that stays at home to photograph blisters. Let's get started with Oliver Callan, who reinstated his morning monologue so we could talk about, what else, the weather, and go from the rain into the weekend's sporting review.
Now, the weather is not looking great for us. I see the Irish Daily Mirror reporting this morning. Put away the sun cream and break out the brollies. Met Aaron has warned it's going to rain every day for the coming week and the June bank holiday next weekend, looking like a washout. The coming week is set to start off with wet today. Little respite from the rain in the days ahead. It'll feel more like March than May regarding the temperatures. We needed the rain, but did we really need this much of it? And what are we going to? What did we ever do to deserve this? Ireland, though, we have great indoors, and some of us are indoors watching the telly. It's very hard to watch some of the matches, though, with the rain splattered across the cameras as it was at the weekend. Extraordinary weekend in Gaelic football. Three of the provincial champions lost their opening group matches. That is how wild and exciting this football championship is in 2025. We know Galway lost to Dublin last weekend, the Connacht champions, but Tyrone beat Donegal, a great win for them at the weekend. And of course, Leinster champions Louth, who are having the season of their lives, went down to Monaghan. Oh. But nobody is out yet, however. Kerry's the only one to carry on undefeated in terms of provincial champions. They beat the Rossies last weekend. Not looking good for the Rossies. And Eamon Sweeney is writing on The Independent this morning, "Whisper it, but this year's hurling fair badly needs a dose of football excitement." This is like going down into the rabbit hole vortex altogether. Football is the main event and hurling is the sideshow this season. Ireland's beautiful game needs two outstanding provincial finals to change the balance of power back in its favour. This is the kind of dead rubber matches that we've been watching over the weekend in hurling, which used to be the powerhouse. And we used to say, well, if only football was exciting, half as exciting as hurling. He says, if Cork and Galway don't rise to the occasion in a fortnight's time, hurling could face a long, lukewarm summer playing second fiddle to its once ugly sibling, which is what football was seen as. And it's a scenario, as he points out, which seemed crazy 12 months ago, but football is the revelation and hurling is underwhelming in comparison. Just two genuine contenders remain in hurling. He means Limerick and Kilkenny, of course. The Treaty are the white hot favourites. The quest for Lee McCarthy could pale next to that for Sam Maguire, because half a dozen football teams possess genuine claims to the title and will for some time. And he concludes, the revolutionary spirit of football's new model armies has turned the GAA world upside down. Galway and Cork will have to rescue the season and the summer for hurling. In women's football, it's as you were, it's not as exciting there, unfortunately, although Kerry did have an exciting finish. They retained the Munster title and Galway retained the Connacht title. Not a scort in sight. Well, it never was in football, but it's gone from the women playing hurling as well forever now too.
And thank goodness for that. At last, the Camogie Association joining the rest of us in the 21st century. But now let's pivot to someone who won't be joining us in the green lobby, J.D. Vance.
The Sunday Times reporting of the DUP commissioned a report to find out the exact Ulster links with Donald Trump's vice president, J.D. Vance, because he's a self-declared Scots-Irish. That's where he puts the hillbilly in his hillbilly elegy. And there was a John Vance in Tyrone, and they thought, well, he was probably a planter who arrived from Scotland, and they may have had descendants who went over to the Appalachians and started the Vance American ancestry. But the historians went through and searched, and they found zero links between this Vance and the JD's family. So the DUP hoped to present him with a shiny document proving his Ulster heritage, but it turns out the Veep has no Irish ancestry whatsoever, despite those shamrock socks in the Oval Office on St. Patrick's Day. So Tyrone is off the hook. They would be very, very happy with that altogether.
Talk about dodging a particularly odious bullet there. County Tyrone and all who sail in her can breathe a sigh of relief today. And, well, that's it for a truncated monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan. Onward! How do you know the person you're speaking to online is really the person you think they are? This was the question Claire Byrne posed this morning, and to try and get some class of an answer to that question, she turned to Elaine Burke, journalist and host of the For Tech's Sake podcast.
So are we saying now if you're speaking to your mother, you'll need her to have a password to verify that it's really her?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like we're living in an age of paranoia, but because these scams are easy to launch and becoming more prevalent, it's not a bad idea. And even it doesn't have to be necessarily that you establish a password, but it could be that if you're in a conversation and you are a little bit suspicious about, if there's a sense of urgency and an ask of money being created, that's always a time to be suspicious in these scenarios, to ask things that only the person that you're meant to be speaking to would know as well.
So, Elaine, I know you said, you know, this sounds as though we're all being very paranoid, but this whole area of how to deal with image and voice impersonation, it is a big topic in cybersecurity, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's not coming from a sense of unreality, because not only is this, it's possible to recreate someone's voice or recreate even their image and make it look like they're in a live video call with some of the most advanced tools out there. It's the fact that this has already been known to happen and to have duped people. I think it was 2 years ago, the National Cybersecurity Agency out of the US had issued in one of their threat reports that there was a case where a CEO of a company had been imitated being on a Zoom call with an employee and requesting a money transfer. And this wasn't even a very sophisticated deep fake, like using the technology to fake a person's image and voice. But they kind of alluded to that by saying that, oh, it's a bad connection. So the fact that the video was maybe jumpy and a bit low quality and the audio wasn't in sync was explained away by saying it was a bad connection as well.
So at the moment, the examples that we're seeing, most of them anyway, of this right now, there would be texts where the scammers have managed to get information and they can have a conversation with you on text that makes it seem as though you're talking to your child or your friend or your sibling. But things are moving on quickly, aren't they, into voice impersonations and into video as well. And that's using captured information.
Sometimes, yeah. Now, sometimes it is like scammers are always looking for low-hanging fruit and the path of least resistance to get to what they want. So it can be a case that they have just blanket texted a bunch of numbers that they got from a data set that was retrieved from a breach and hoping that someone in that subset of numbers has a child of a certain age who lives abroad, because that is a very common thing that happens. And then they, you know, send a text from an unknown number saying, oh, I was out last night, I lost my phone, I need you to wire money to me. Sometimes it is just kind of a blanket approach like that, but we are seeing these instances of more targeted, what are called social engineering attacks, essentially. And even some of the most high profile breaches that you would have become aware of in recent times, a lot of them stem back to some form of social engineering. And what that means is that not just kind of sending these blanket messages out there, but more specific targeted scams to capture people. And that might be, you know, using a synthetic voice, using synthetic media that they may be familiar with. So replicating an Instagram login or replicating a platform that they know that you are a user of and creating a login page for that. So it's just being more specific and targeted with these scams.
Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to using your voice, how are they managing to get hold of your voice that they can then use?
In some cases, it could just be that, like, they do just try to fake a voice and hope for the best, like the voice of a young woman with a specific accent, and just target a bunch of numbers in that and hope to hit upon someone that this resonates with. But if they wanted to replicate a specific voice, it's gotten to the point where with good enough technology, you would only need a few seconds of audio of someone to replicate their voice and get it to say things that they never said before and make it sound pretty high fidelity. And there are cases of people using that, you know, for one CEO used it to announce his earnings results. He faked his own image and his own voice. So people are using it for nearly stunts and PR campaigns, essentially. But obviously these tools can be used nefariously as well.
So it's probably not a bad idea to set up a password with your family and friends.
It's interesting. I mean, I was literally speaking to a man who was like a leader in cybersecurity in the States last week, and he said the very same thing that this other executive had said, that he has this code word that he has with his family members specifically. He is a high ranking member of a organization, and he works in cybersecurity, so you kind of expect him to have the highest level of this kind of awareness. But he's also, he said it's about trying to actually instill cybersecurity practices like this amongst his kids as well, who are quite young, but they're very online. Mm-hmm. And he wants them to be aware of things like scams and being careful about data that you share online, and being aware that what you see and what you hear may not always be what you think it is, and you do have to have often take precautions around that.
Shame we need it, really, but good advice nonetheless from Elaine Burke, journalist and host of the For Tech's Sake podcast, talking cybersecurity with Claire Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, our host played some pre-recorded audio of his visit to the Happy Out Together Academy Cafe in Dunleary Baths in County Dublin. Ray sat with the Together Academy founder, Therese Coveney, Brian Hanratty, the owner of Happy Out, and Charlie O'Reilly, winner of the All-Ireland Employee Excellent Award at the recent Irish Restaurant Awards.
Charlie, I have to say congratulations, because you won an award last week.
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah.
Yeah, at the Restaurants of Ireland's award. What did you get?
I get a Sporty Award for in Abbey Out and Trill Academy.
Yes, and it's for your brilliant work.
And a bit of work. I love working here because I like Brian so much.
Is he one of your best pals?
Thanks, Charlie.
Yes, yeah.
So congratulations, and I believe you got an award for here, an award for home. You've, how many awards in all did you get?
I got 3 awards.
That's exceptional.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I was so happy I got the awards.
Yeah. And what was the reaction from the audience on the night?
Someone did clapping to me.
Yeah.
And all my friends and all my colleagues cheering for me. I was so happy I got the award. I didn't realize my name coming in.
You got a stand ovation.
Yeah.
Yeah, stand ovation.
Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like, Brian?
Oh, it was great. And like, there'd been a lot of, they do go through a lot of awards, but once Charlie's name got called out, the whole room erupted. Like, and there was the full room stood up and clapping. It was honestly amazing. I didn't expect everyone to react like that.
Yeah. I believe you're gone global as well, Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a message from someone from South Africa the other day, a message from a friend in New York. Like, everyone all over the world has seen it. It's such a heartwarming thing.
And it must have been heartwarming for you, Therese, to see this.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. To talk about the messages, I mean, we've had messages this weekend from people who have children with disabilities saying that they can see a brighter future for them. It's been incredibly satisfying for us to see that, you know, we knew that when we gave Charlie and so many of his colleagues in Happy Out, we've 15 young adults with Down syndrome working out here now. And we really felt that if we put the right supports with them and trusted them to do the job, that they would succeed. And I think Charlie would accept that this recognition is for all of the young adults who work here and who work, anybody with a disability who's working. It's changing the dial on the expectations for their community. And that's wonderful. Wonderful, yeah. As a parent of a child with Down syndrome as well, to know that there's a brighter future ahead.
So April... What age is April?
April is 14 now.
Right, and she has Down syndrome. And
she does.
That's part of the reason we're sitting here now, I suppose.
Absolutely. Myself and 4 other moms who have children with Down syndrome wanted to do something different, and our children were attending the Down Syndrome Centre, and they supported us in trying to get a new project and a new way of training and a new way of teaching and then a new way of work for this community. And we was partnering with people like Brian has really, really helped us to kind of put our young adults into the most cool, iconic settings, working and earning their own income. It's been amazing.
So when you saw the world through April's eyes,
yes,
what did you see?
When April was born, we didn't see a bright future, but very quickly we decided that we wanted to put the right supports around her like her brothers would have. And I think in the very short 14 years, the world has changed and businesses have changed and families have changed in their expectations, and hopefully government policy will change. And, you know, it's by doing and by seeing that the true inclusive society, you know, is lived out. And that's just what we're right behind now and pushing for.
There's a very special atmosphere in the Happy Out in Dunleary here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's different to anywhere you get anything you get anywhere else, yeah.
And it's because of Charlie and Leah and Kira.
Yeah, and all the team else. And the kind of the inclusiveness of the whole place. And even though the our typically developing staff, they all work together as one, you know. And that's, I think, the big change.
There's a system.
There is a system. There's a lot of supports go around it. But like now, like we're open. This is our third summer. And they all work together. And, you know, we kind of, you have to move around a lot here. It gets very busy all of a sudden, or it can be quite quiet. So they all just row in together, and it's kind of one team, which is the true goal of inclusion. Obviously, there's lots of sports from Together Academy, and it's, you know, you have to work on a lot of things all the time. But yeah, like it just creates this nice vibe. Everyone working together, everyone loves working here, and everyone has. There's just generally a very nice, positive.
And you became a dad recently for the first time.
I did, yes.
Has that changed your view of the world?
It certainly, yeah, it does. It changes what you want for the country, like what you want, I want Cass to grow up with, and more places like here and more cafes hiring people. And you want, you know, you also want Cass and your family to be proud of what you're doing, which is always what kind of geared me towards doing it, but it's definitely stronger now, yeah.
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 And Charlie, do you have a member of staff that you hang out with here?
That's a really, really good question, Ray. I like Brian because Brian's a nice businessman and he's a calm person ever. And I like Trace and Cathy. And I met Cathy and Trace, Brian and my colleagues.
Yeah.
I feel proud of myself, and I really miss Cathy so much.
Yeah. And you've two brothers. You're the eldest.
Yeah.
First out, as you say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you the boss in the family?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes my dad always messes with my brothers, but I not listen, grab them more and more again.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a plan for something big in October.
I do the marathon.
Right.
At the end of it.
That's big, isn't it? And are your brothers doing it with you?
Yeah. And then I do the hockey in... I just did hockey in... competing in Bulgaria and Germany.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Don't worry, I keep tabs on all these things.
So, Therese, this happened a bit by accident, didn't it? The whole thing.
Well, it's...
we were set up where?
We work out of Wanderers Rugby Club. Right. We have a classroom there and we have a training cafe there where Charlie would have learned his skills. Mm. The end result is this beautiful space, and Brian volunteered with us. He encouraged he encouraged me in particular to buy a very expensive coffee machine and to do a cafe. He always said, like, people will come once out of curiosity. They'll only come back if the product is excellent. So we developed a good, keep kind of mentored me a little bit at the start, and then when this location came up at Dunleary Vet Town, we looked at it and we knew that we didn't really meet the criteria for it, so we approached Brian and said we'd love to go into partnership, and that has proven to be just such a magic combination, and it has worked really, really well for the two entities, which is fantastic.
And a magic location, Brian.
It doesn't get any better than this. Yeah, like, it's absolutely beautiful, and like the view at the windows, even just the amount of people actually see swimming and using it on the weekends, or, you know, we've sunrise yogas on Wednesday mornings, and, you know, and then being able to wake up, come out. Some of the sunrises here are just incredible.
Yeah. Hate you.
Yeah, they're just brilliant.
I was out here over the weekend and people just sit outside and it's like they're mesmerized, nearly hypnotized by the view.
Yeah.
Special.
Just
sit there.
They just sit there and they can sit there for ages.
But that's what you were popping for you, isn't it? Yeah. The view's too good.
Yeah, yeah.
The view's too good, Charlie.
It's just good, yeah.
It's like arguable, like, this site was kind of controversial at the time because there was, you know, a lot of decisions being made about what would be done with it. But we really get a sense that the local community are thrilled with this cafe and the visitors. And as Ryan says, the yoga, people, yoga and families. I mean, people really, really love this Cafe. And I mean, we do think it is the combination of that inclusive space where people maybe behave a little bit better, we ask people to take a few more minutes to not get as fussed if there's a queue. Our young adults do all of the roles here, from barista to the till to the floor. And I just feel it creates a really, really special atmosphere.
I know you said that Charlie's award was on behalf of everybody here.
Absolutely.
But you might say something nice about Charlie, would you?
Well, Charlie is a very, very special young man. He knows that. Charlie would have been one of our first students who came through the door at Together Academy. I don't think he ever missed a day of college, and that was through COVID. I don't think we've ever had a customer make a complaint. People tell us, everyone who meets us tell us, well, lovely feeling they have when they spend time with Charlie. And he'll always greet you with a smile. And he's just utterly reliable and professional. And he takes his job seriously, you know. So he's tremendous. We're so proud of him.
Yeah.
And one thing all of his colleagues said, actually, when he got that award, was that it was well deserved.
Therese Coveney there, founder of the Together Academy, along with Brian Hanratty, the owner of Happy Out, and the award-winning Charlie O'Reilly, all talking to Ray Darcy and Dunleary on this afternoon's show. Daniel McInaspy was the first child to be killed while in the care of the state. On this morning's Oliver Callan, Daniel's sister Katrina spoke to Oliver about how she wants the state to apologise for the lapses in care that led to her brother's death.
Daniel and my brother Keith, they were very, very close.
Yeah.
So they had each other, and then when they got split,
yeah,
that was really, really hard for both of them. One went to live with my auntie Pamela and, well, Keith. And then obviously Daniel was moved around. That's when it kind of starts.
Because we can see when you got help, you and Nikita, that your life comes together and you go on to have a normal life despite the horrible trauma and grief in your life. The documents that come out of the inquest show that the failings really begin for Daniel when he's taken into care, isn't he? He loses education effectively as a result of simple things not being noticed, like he had dyslexia.
Yeah, like in the inquest, like, we heard a child that has dyslexia, you should be second class, you know, where that they should have known. But Daniel was like...
It's an easy thing to sort out, to educate people with dyslexia.
So, I think he was like 14, 15 before that came.
And that's when they realised, but at that stage he can't read or write.
No, and from a very young age, that's all he ever wanted to do.
It's very sad because he liked school.
Yeah, he really, really did. He wanted to learn.
Hmm.
And, you know, obviously his little mind, and he didn't realise, why can't they? But he was never told. He obviously knew he couldn't read and write, and that, like, he was embarrassed about that.
Really?
Yeah, he was very embarrassed about that. Like, so that's one thing he really wanted to do, was to read and write.
Like, to carry that shame around him, it's just appalling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's the simplest thing in the world to fix. And it was just dyslexia. Lots of people have very, very intelligent people as well.
Yeah.
He had a positive regard for school. He leaves school, obviously, because he's not taken care of there. And he ends up living in the streets, essentially. He's even attacked quite dangerously, isn't he?
Yeah, he got 14. Stabbed when he was 14 in the neck.
In the neck?
Yeah, in the neck. Roaming the streets of the city centre.
He ends up in Temple Street Children's Hospital.
He did, yeah.
Where was he living then at that stage? Do you know where he was sleeping?
No, I'd imagine it was there out of service. But after that, that's when my auntie Sabrina took Daniel.
You had great aunties.
Yeah, they were brilliant and still are brilliant to us.
And I'm sure they had their own things going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had a lot of trauma in their own lives, you know, but they stood by us all.
So Auntie Sabrina's trying to take in Daniel around this time.
He's
been attacked and injured on the street. He doesn't have any school. But then Daniel, being a nice kid, he doesn't really want to be a burden to Auntie Sabrina. Is that right?
No, he was in with my other aunties, a couple of them before that. But like that, no space. They had their own kids. You know, they still took them. But after then, the attack on him, Sabrina did take him, and he lived with Sabrina for like 2 years.
Right.
And she got him into FOSS, the outreach centre.
Yeah.
He was doing well, but it broke down again because, like, no one came to Sabrina to see how Daniel was, see, were they okay? He was just left there, and
There was no follow-up or connection to who?
Not really, no. No. And
there's an incident in the false course, which again comes back to the shame of his dyslexia not being able to read or write, and this has a profound impact on him.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, like that, he wanted to read and write, and there was like obviously a group in his FOSS, and he just got embarrassed, like, if he had to read out or...
He was asked to read something out loud, was that?
Yeah, it was something like that. And like that, he was embarrassed that he couldn't do it, like, so that he left.
He leaves the course, and that's the only stable thing, really.
That really was,
so
yeah.
So naturally, he ends up back on the streets, about 15 years of age. People will be familiar with the chaotic life of people in this area, particularly who work in this area, someone with no education, no work. He's a young teenager. Drugs are readily available on the streets, and that's
and
what happens.
And that's what he turned to, yeah. You know, he's a 15-year-old on the streets. You know, all he's looking for is a family, somewhere safe. He had us as a family, but, I mean, he knew, he felt, always felt that he was... Boredom to us, like, as in
you were getting on with your life. No.
Yeah, and you know, he knew there was never room, and he just wanted the HSE just to provide him with security, you know. So
did you have much contact with him during that time?
Yeah, all the time. He wouldn't, you know, he was always around us.
He really desperately wants help. He's taking tablets, smoking cannabis. There was a suicide attempt.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I heard it in the inquest.
You didn't know that until now, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that about the suicide attempt. I heard that in court, so...
What do you know about it? Is he taken to hospital? Does he get any care?
I think he was taken to hospital, yeah, to Temple Street, and there was nothing they could do for him or something, so... Again, he was left on the streets.
He's back out even after that.
And that's when I think he knew himself he needed help and he wanted to help. And
along the way, the HSE appoints, or there's someone appointed by the courts, is that right, by the HSE to represent Daniel in the legal proceedings. He's not taking drugs, I believe, for this period.
No, they drug test him and it came back clear.
So he was fighting to live and
he
to survive.
He really was.
How does he get someone appointed to him in the end?
Well, Aileen was appointed to all of us, I think, when my mum passed away. So we were...
I see, there is a contact there.
Yeah, we didn't need her anymore. So she was gone. But the social workers went back and asked her for help to be Daniel's voice.
Okay.
So that's how she comes back on the scene.
So little bits of the system work here. And Aileen Dunn is her name.
Yeah. Yeah,
formidable, brilliant woman.
Yeah.
And really cares about her
job.
She
really did, and she really tried her best.
She had lovely things to say about your brother.
Yes, and she got very, very upset in court.
In the inquest.
A couple of times.
What did she tell you at the inquest about Daniel?
He was like that, funny. Like that, he wanted help, and she knew that. And she was his voice, and she, like, Daniel kept saying to her, like, I really need somewhere to go, and she fought for that, and... And never happened.
She said he didn't have a bad bone in his body. And that was important because when he, and the way he's killed in the end, all sorts of rumours swirl about anyone who is even just adjacent to drugs or being
a lot of people has came out and kind of said Daniel was murdered over a drug debt. That's not true.
Totally false. Yeah.
Daniel was in the, like, ended up in Blanche that night to meet a girl and just came across these two guys, and that's why he was killed. Like, but it was nothing got to do with drugs or anything like that.
Aileen Dunn, nobody really works harder than her. She pushes for secure accommodation over and over again, doesn't she?
Yeah.
How badly is the state failing in this regard? How many attempts are made to get him accommodation?
There was like 3 or 4 applications, and every one of them were refused. And she said he met all the ticks that. For someone to be in a secure unit, Daniel met each and every one of those ticks for him to be in a secure unit.
Because he was in danger.
Yeah.
And repeatedly the state has told over and over.
What child asks to be locked up? You know, he asked that.
Yeah.
For, you know, he wanted help, and that was the only way out. Lock me up, help me.
Again, at the time, it's not TUSLA, which is the organisation people are familiar with these days. It's the HSE Care Committee. They're told 3 times in the year before he's murdered that he needs somewhere safe, but there was no bed. Is that the reason?
This is what we've been told. Yeah, There was no beds available for Daniel.
There was talk about sending him to Sweden for to a treatment care.
Yeah, Sweden. Yeah, and that was refused.
There was a clinical psychologist who spoke to the inquest, and he met Daniel 20 times, I think it was. You'd never heard from this person before.
I never heard his report, and that shocked me.
What did you find out?
A lot. That Daniel had post-traumatic stress disorder. He had the... I'm forgetting the word. he had a few things going on, and just one that stuck out with me was the fact that he was in court the day before Daniel was murdered, like saying this child needs to be put away, like locked up for his own safety. He's not
the day before.
The day before. And that shocked me.
And this took 15 years for you to find out.
Yeah.
That's Katrina McAdaspy, whose brother Daniel was murdered at the age of just 17 while in the care of the state. Katrina was talking to Oliver Callan this morning. Millie McCarthy is a 10-year-old girl from Cork, and everything she touches turns to catastrophe. Millie is a character created by children's author Leona Ford, who joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about the latest Millie McCarthy book, Wild Atlantic Antics. It's quite hard to say that. Wild Atlantic Antics.
Parents kind of worry sometimes. They're like, oh, I can't get them to read other books. But it doesn't matter. Whatever a child is reading, whether they be graphic novels or chapter books or their same picture book over and over again, it does not matter once they're reading.
Mm-hmm. We're reading this in my house at the moment at bedtime. So Millie's school get bounced into a trip to the Gaeltacht, a quick trip to Kerry.
They do, because of a lie told by the principal. And the inspector comes in and she wants to know what's happening with extracurricular activities. So Mr. Manley, under a panic, says, oh, we're going to the Gaeltacht. And Millie is delighted because she's never been on a sleepover before. And this is a chance to go to the Gaeltacht with all of her friends and stay overnight.
Yes. And I've noticed as well, there's a lot more Irish peppered through the book this year. This time, is that, were you asked to do that?
There was a teacher came up and she says, I love getting the sneaky little bits of Irish in. And my own kids go to a Gael school as well. And, you know, sometimes getting them to read in Irish can be a bit difficult. So it's like, you know, sneaking the veg into the pasta sauce.
Yes.
Sneaking the bit of Irish. And she said, I'd like a bit more Irish. And I thought, well, how will I do that? I'll send Millie down to Kerry, down to the Gaeltacht. And it was around the year that my boy was going on his first overnight trip to the Gaeltacht as well. So I got lovely little insights into what actually happens.
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, I love the bit that we were reading last night was when they're on the train. And Millie goes to the loo. She's never been to the bathroom on a train before. And she doesn't know what the red cord is for.
And so, of course, she pulls it.
And so many people don't know. And she decides to pull it. And there's a bit of a catastrophe around that as well. I was wondering, though, when I was reading the Irish, and I think it's lovely to come across it. Do you have an eye to an international audience? And do you ever think, well, that might, you know, prevent people in the UK from enjoying the book? Does that cross your mind at all?
It doesn't. Well, it does in one sense. I've been asked about it a couple of times. And I say the way I write it is that even if you don't have Irish, you can understand it. Because I will say things like, and then Muintir Emer told us all Sigi Shias, so we all sat down.
Yes.
And so it'll come across in the meaning of it, or else Karen's illustrations are brilliant. And so she'll often do a little illustration of a school book, and then the word Mála Scola comes out of it so that the child or the parent who's reading it can understand it. And then I think what has become really popular, I've got loads of people saying, I'm sending these books to my family in Australia, I'm sending them to America, I'm sending them to Britain. So if you have the Irish heritage, it's a lovely way of keeping it alive. And I think Irish has become so much more popular. You see now all of these influencers, all of these TikTok stars, and they're doing Frosnalay and the kids are picking it up. And even I know this, my own kids will say things in Irish without even thinking of it. They'll say slán going out the door. They'll say, you know, where my broga, without even thinking. So
yeah,
it's becoming more popular.
You sneak the Irish in a very, you know, in a way that you barely even notice it. You know, it works in a lovely way. And it encourages all of us, I think, to use it a bit more frequently as well. And I also love how the new character in here is the SNA.
Yeah.
Mrs. S. And she's lovely.
She is. And I was thinking about that. Up and down our country, in every school, we have classroom assistants and SNAs, and they are the lifeblood of the education system. Like, I couldn't teach my classes without having my SNAs in there. They're so kind and so supportive, and they make everything so inclusive. And I thought, how do I not have an SNA in my book? So my new character is Mrs. S, And she's named after an SNA that I worked with for many years, who I got on great with. And I just thought this is a character that needs to be in the book because I like the books being inclusive and I like them reflecting true life. And true life is having classroom assistants in our rooms.
And our example from last night, everyone was cross with poor Millie for pulling the red cord on the train. But Mrs. S said it could happen to anybody.
Exactly.
And she was right. It could happen to anybody.
And it has happened in our family. Now, I won't say
who. Oh, really?
Yeah. And I pull things from my family life all the time. So when this book came out, I had to tell my husband, who purchased a pair of Crocs in the brightest yellow possible, that I had put them in. So in the book it says, and if I told the truth about Daddy's hideous coloured Crocs, he would have gotten very cross. So I had to admit that I used him in the book as well.
Yeah, Crocs are very popular in our house as well, but maybe the bright yellow. I see where the line is there with you, right? Now, the last time you were in, you were telling us about how you write, because you are still teaching.
Yeah.
And I don't know where you get the time, and you're busy with your family, of course, as well. Is that becoming more of a struggle as the success grows?
No, because I still kind of find that hidden time. I like to write at night time when the kids are in bed. And then yesterday I was on the train for 2.5 hours. So the headphones went on and the paper and pen came out. And I just wrote for those 2.5 hours straight. And I think it's because it's something I enjoy. It doesn't feel like work.
Mm-hmm. But you're still teaching. Is it
still teaching?
4 days a week?
4 days a week in Kinsale at the moment. Yeah. And I've Mondays off. So I write all day Monday.
So you sit down on a Monday. That's your day for writing.
That's my day for writing. Yeah. Or else I will do some classroom visits or some library visits as well on a Monday. And that's almost like writing as well, because I'm surrounded by kids who are coming up to me going, Leona, I have an idea for a book. I think you need to do this. And can you bring Millie camping, and can you send her here, there and everywhere? And I come out with a raft of ideas for more books.
Yeah, well, it's great to get that from the horse's mouth, you know, if you like, from, you know, the people who are reading and loving the books, that they're telling you what Millie should do next. So I take it that the next one is in the bag, is it, in the can?
It is. We have one coming out in October, and that will be the Haunted House one.
The Haunted House.
Haunted House, hullabaloo.
Yeah, she's going to get into a lot of trouble when she goes to a haunted house. Now, tell me about the hairy toes.
So the hairy toes belong to me. And I can't believe I'm saying this on national radio, but I was shaving my legs one day and one of the kids was watching me and I shaved my toe. And she said, "Mom, do you have hairy toes?" And I said, "Yeah." And she was like, "Oh, I wouldn't wear sandals if I was you." So, of course, in the book, Millie gets given out to when she tells the lady in Sally's shoe shop that the real reason her mom doesn't wear sandals is because of her extremely hairy toes.
I love it. See, this is why they're so successful, because you're taking those.
Nothing is sacred.
Yeah, and the real life experiences as well. Do children love that when you're true to real life? Karen Hart, I mentioned, really brings this book to life with you. And it's extraordinary how it just jumps off the page, those
Absolutely.
Illustrations.
I love her illustrations. They just add an entire new layer of fun to the book. Like, there's a fantastic illustration in this book and the kids go to this local little shop in Kerry and it is the greengrocer and the post office and the gift shop and they sell everything from shoes to sushi and she just captures that so brilliantly. And then there's another little illustration as well that I love in the book, and it's Millie's decided she needs to do a project. It won't ruin too much. On insects. So Karen has drawn this stack of books and even the names of them, mathematics and the secret life of flies, you know, for that added layer of little extra meaning and extra fun. It's brilliant.
And we were talking about graphic novels in general on the programme a couple of weeks ago and how the process works. Just remind us how you work with Karen.
Yeah, so I will write the story and then it gets sent to my editor, Venetia, and she will suggest little images or vignettes and I might as well. And then Karen as well will come up with her own ideas and then she will do rough drawings and they're sent back. We'll have a look at them and then we'll tease out which ones we're going to put in the book and then she'll go and she'll do the drawings to the final finish.
A little behind the scenes on how books with illustrations for children come together from author Leona Ford on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Leona's latest Millie McCarthy book, Wild Atlantic Antics, is published by Gill Books. This afternoon on Liveline, Joe Duffy heard the shocking claim that Lahinch in County Clare is going down the Swanee. A, what does that mean? And B, why? Local County Councillor Bill Slattery blames, stay with me here, the lack of amenities for camper vans and recreational vehicles.
I had a motion in last week. I'm a local county councillor here in Lahinch. I was born and reared on the promenade in Lahinch. And I am just a bit disappointed the way our car park, and we haven't a very big car park in Lahinch for the amount of people that's coming in there at the moment, especially there in the fine weekends or in any day it's fine, even with day trippers. And the influx of not camper vans, but there are professional camper vans that are fully equipped with toilet facilities and chemical toilets and the whole lot. But we have certain vans coming in that are not converted, and they may have a mattress in the back of them, or they might have something for sleeping overnight. And we have only provision in our car park in Lahinch for 5 camper vans. But unfortunately, last weekend, the fine weekend, and there's no overnight parking allowed, even for those 5 camper vans.
Okay.
So last weekend, we had 32 camper vans overnighting on Friday night and Saturday night. And some of them, not all of them, had no proper tile facilities, and a lot of them don't, then a lot of them do. And I'm not parenting everyone here with the same brush. I know we have beautiful camper vans coming in with professional people, and they know how to look after their...
But still, Bill, in fairness, you're right. They have to be emptied as well.
Yes, they have to be emptied, but they're emptying their waste into our public toilets.
Yeah.
And it's not right, and for the environment and even for the people going in using the public toilets. And the car park has been totally blocked. Now, we had bylaws, but they're not being enforced. And so at the end of the parking charges, you can park if you come down job with your car, you're charged €2 for 3 hours in Lahinch to park for 3 hours. But a camper van can come in for 10 hours and pay €4. Right. But when the traffic warden goes away at 6 or 6:30, that camper van stays overnight and comes out again the following morning at 10 o'clock and gets another ticket for €4. So they can stay for 5 days for €20 with no facilities and block up the whole promenade in the whole car park in Lahinch. And that was my point of coming across with my motion there last week.
But why would the camper vans, or indeed the other vans, and there's a lot of them, you're right, especially after COVID, people... there's an upsurge in the porches, which are very expensive, but also people banging together the back of the Ford Transit or the Mercedes Sprinter and turning it into a makeshift. But why should they pay more when they're getting no facilities?
But you see, they shouldn't be there because the facilities aren't there. And that's the reason that there's no overnight parking allowed, because we don't have the facilities. And what I'm trying to do here is to put pressure on Clare County Council to provide a designated site with all the facilities that we can push camper vans overnight, 20 or 30 of them, with all the facilities.
But Bill, we've been hearing this for 20 or 30 years.
Yes. Yeah, but Clare County Council are listening to me, and I'm a local representative.
And what do they say? Do they say we don't have the money, we don't have the...
Yeah, they say we don't have the money, or we're not in that type of business. If somebody wants to... provide a camper van site, which we have one or two people in the area that are willing to invest in providing camper van sites. But the council are telling me that no, we won't give planning permission because they're in a scenic route or this or that. And as you know, Lahinch property is at a premium in Lahinch even to buy anything. Yeah. So I'm having difficulty trying to convince Clare County Council, even though they commissioned a survey last year that this was badly needed in North Clare, let it be Liscannor or Lahinch or Listunvarna or someplace. But yes, the wheel is not there for them to provide it.
And Joe at RT.ie, hang on with me, Bill. You're very good, appreciate Joe at RT.ie. Aaron, it's not the third secret of Fatima that there are no facilities for camper vans in Ireland, is it?
No, it's well known at this stage. Yeah. Sure, we must be on with you every second year about the same thing, lack of facilities. There are fabulous campsites in Ireland, Joe. Mm-hmm. Fabulous campsites in Ireland. But there are no facilities like that chap was saying about that county councils could provide for us. And the money we would bring to a small town or village over a weekend is astronomical.
And why? Why is it not improved?
Listen, that chap can't even answer that, and he's a local councillor. There's no answer. They just don't want us. Not every town, no, not every county. There are towns and counties that have looked after us and are delighted with the extra income over the weekends and during the week, because there are retired people and young people that go camping. Yeah, I go camping any day of the week. There's no answer, Joe. I've had this conversation on your show with Katie and on other radio stations. There's no answer. Nobody will give us a definitive answer. So there's the councillor can't even get a definitive answer from his council.
John Whelan, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
Have you an answer?
I do. The councillor Bill there is missing a golden opportunity. Instead of complaining and blaming camper van owners, he should get the council to do their job.
Because he says they won't do it. Bill is blue in the face.
No, he's blaming the wrong people. I go to Lahinch every week. I'm as well known down there in my camper van as a begging ass. And surfing is a huge economic boom to Lahinch. And you go to Joe's Cafe, Spoonies on the Prom, Randaddy's, Kenny's Pub, music, food all day. I mean, the taverns and the shops and the businesses in Lahinch all welcome the surfers and the campervanners who are an economic driver. So instead of complaining about it and putting up barriers, he should be looking for them to put up facilities. And campervan owners have no problem paying a tenner a night to park up, and to all they're asking is for a fresh water pint. And the place down there, there's a great new public toilet block in Lahinch, and I agree, no one should tip their toilet cassette into the public toilets. But around the back, all you have to do is put a service area where you can do that as part of the facilities. And it's a win-win. And all over France, in some of the loveliest cities in the world, La Rochelle, Nantes, Biarritz, they do this right beside five-star hotels. This is we should be pushing it up the door, and up the door, up the road in Ennis Diamond is Vanderlust campervan builders. One of the great expertise and local employer designing and building campervans as a local business. So you know they're coming at it from the entirely wrong direction.
County council, it's not our job to run camping sites, sir.
Oh, no, that's not true. The thing is that in every city in Europe, every town and village in France...
Half of them can't build a house.
Well, then we shouldn't have art centres or swimming pools if we go down that road either. So, look, the thing is that all this is an earner. It can be an economic driver, an employer, and raise funds for the local authority. It need not be a drain.
By the way, if I register a camper van, if I convert to Fortransit or Sprinter or whatever,
yes,
I do it myself. You know, you can buy stuff. Do I have to re-register that as a camper van?
Yes, you do. Yes. Yes, you do. And there's a VRT tax. And that way you're paying again into the economy, and then you're registered and qualified to drive a camper van, and it's competent and verified and certified as so. So there's none of this garden that the councillor said.
Reverse there for a few minutes, John, a few seconds. How much? Follow the money. How much does the government get when you? What did you buy a new camper van? What did you do?
No, so I got a Ford Transit van, what you'd call a builder's van or a panel van.
Yeah, great van.
In the garage in Portlaoise, and went to Ennis Diamond to Dave Hanley and his team, and they do up a design for you, Joe, like if you're doing a fitted kitchen.
Brilliant.
And they show you, look, here's what'll fit. And in the van, he tells me every millimetre is important real estate. You have to maximise all your space.
Yeah.
I have a toilet, shower, cooker, fridge, two beds, and roof rack for the surfboards, bike rack for the bikes, and you're all set to go.
That's John Whelan, campervan owner, talking about facilities for campervan owners, or the lack thereof, in Lahinch, County Clare, and in many other parts of the country, with Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, on this morning's Oliver Callan, storm chaser, yes, that's what he calls himself, Noel Fitzpatrick, talked about his job chasing the weather.
But so I always had an interest. Growing up, the options to storm chase in Sligo were fairly limited. You know, I'd sort of pretend there was a thunderstorm coming over the hills. But after my first storm chasing trip proper in the States was after my graduation from my PhD. It was kind of like a treat to myself. And photography was something I was always interested in as well. Mm-hmm. So they're two really nice, they go really well together. So that was my first trip after after my PhD. And from then
was
on...
Was that in the places we expect, Oklahoma and
yes,
so on?
Yes, that's right. So the central states of the US. So they refer to them as sort of Tornado Alley. So it's like Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas. And you just get a merger of kind of the perfect conditions for these kind of thunderstorms, particularly this time of the year. And so if you really want to see spectacular storms, you kind of have to travel to see them.
Right. And you have to know what you're doing.
You do, yeah.
It helps having all these PhDs and so
it
on.
It does. Yes, but even saying that, I wouldn't call myself, you know, I wouldn't say I know everything. Like, definitely not. I each time I go out, I try to go with people who have more experience, because it's one of those things that you might know the science, but you really have to have spent time studying these storms to really understand and to be able to watch them and to know what's happening.
So. And also the routes. You didn't need to know yes, all of the roads. And
absolutely,
you're going,
yes. Yeah, the navigation is as important as the science really over there, because you want to know that you have a good route to follow the storm. But also if things turn and you decide I need to get out of this area pretty quickly, you want to make sure you have options pretty much in every direction. So knowing the road network is very important.
Does that mean you can't go storm chasing on your own?
So some people chase on their own. Others will go with a group. I think it's better to go with others because you can dedicate one person to each job. Mm. I have done it on my own as well.
Have you?
And there is a kind of a freedom to that, because particularly for me, because I'm going from a photography point of view. So I have the freedom basically to stop and say, oh, actually, this is a nice shot here. I'm going to take it without annoying other people, right?
Yeah. Because okay, I see what you mean.
That's my focus. I really want to get a nice shot. A nice shot.
And they're distant as well, aren't they? They're beautiful photographs, because you've got the distant tumult and tempest. There's the foreboding skies where you've got yes, a crack of light where it's normal daylight 1 minute and this black, black clouds.
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes to see the best storm, you want to be back a little bit. So yeah, like I was saying before, like I'm not there necessarily to do research. So it doesn't make sense for me to be like super close under the storm, because as gotcha, it is, you actually can't see anything under the storm. You're probably in heavy rain or hail or something like that. And you're putting yourself in danger as well. So for the most part, I will try and stay back a little bit.
Good man.
Particularly if I'm on my own. Yeah. And you usually have a better viewpoint then.
You do have it. There is an academic purpose to the photographs, though, isn't there? You're not just going.
Yes, totally. Trailer, so
risking all of this for nothing.
No, I find them a really good way in starting a conversation. So
yeah,
science communication is something I'm really interested in. And if you can draw people into that conversation without sort of starting by hitting them over the head with things they've already heard before, you know, if you want to talk to them about climate change, if you can show them something spectacular, like an amazing video of a storm or pictures, everybody seems to be interested in that. You know, I give talks in different places, both to public or in schools and things like that. And if you can show them an interesting picture of a storm, it pulls them in. And then you can start talking to them about the science behind it, you know, maybe get them interested in weather and climate. And then some of the more serious issues about why, say, climate change is important.
Yeah. The supercell, is that the name of the cloud? Is that an American expression? Do we have different words?
No, it's pretty global. Supercell basically means a thunderstorm that's rotating.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. So if you have a thunderstorm that rotates, a focusing of that rotation is what gives you a tornado.
Right.
So you're looking for those supercell storms. Yeah.
Is there anywhere else in the world you can go storm chasing, or is it only really
Tornado Alley? Tornado Alley is sort of the most consistent this time of the year in particular.
May and June, yeah.
Yes. But there are places like, for example, the Po River Valley in Italy. So northern Italy in Europe,
really?
They get quite some decent storms
I
there.
Didn't know that, yeah.
Germany gets some as well. And you know, we occasionally
doing more lightning storms rather than tornadoes.
Yes, exactly. Lightning and very big hail as well. Hail is another major risk of these storms.
Like, that's a huge thing in climate change, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Damage,
yeah.
and risk to life and property.
It is, and you see it particularly over in the States. You see these cars driving past and houses, and you think they actually look like they've been shot at, and it's actually hail damage. I was on a storm there a year or so ago, and it had hail 10 centimetres in diameter. So this thing would destroy your car, you know,
wow,
if you got in the wrong place. Yeah.
Were you in the car at the time?
I was, yes, but I wasn't near that part of it.
Wow, that must be an extraordinary thing to even be nearby. Are there many Irish storm chasers?
There's a lot of enthusiasm for storms in Ireland. I'd say those who actually go over and chase are limited enough. But there are some, there's a friend of mine, Paul, who he used to live over there and studied storms over there and has years of chasing experience. So he's a good resource. I've relied on him for lots of experience. But it's definitely growing. And even if when there's a thunderstorm or a series of thunderstorms in Ireland, you do see, I might be out with the camera, and you'll see other people out doing the same thing.
I see. Yeah. So there was lightning around yesterday.
There was indeed, yes. Yeah.
As I'm obsessed with the rainfall radar. Yeah. And you get the crosses, little orange crosses appear.
That's right, yes.
That's
the
lightning strikes, which were across the Midlands. Yeah. And we'll experience a bit of that all through the summer if the conditions are.
Yeah, exactly. We do get thunderstorms here, particularly during the summer. We don't generally have the same amount of energy that you need for the big storms that they get in
the
US.
I was wondering, our storms are a bit lame, are they? Compared to
we have a lot of the conditions. So really for a thunderstorm, what you need is warm air below cold air. So it's a bit like if you put a pot on a stove and the warm air wants to bubble up, or the warm water wants to bubble up through the cold water. That's what you're seeing. Yeah. Same thing happens in the atmosphere. You get warm air below and it wants to bubble up through the cold air above. So in Ireland, we have lots of cold air above us. So it's kind of that relative difference. We don't have that much warm air, but it's warm relative to the cold air above it. So it wants to rise up.
That's why you come into the landlocked bits of Italy, Germany.
Exactly. Yes, exactly right.
Yeah, it's spectacular. Yeah. So you must have like storm chasing friends. There's a proper community, is there?
There is. It's certainly in the States. It's a huge community.
Yeah.
You've people from all kind of backgrounds. People who are in it from a research background. People who are there for the photography side of things. And some people have really educated themselves. They mightn't necessarily have a science background, but they've spent years themselves studying and researching it because they're interested. And I find that really impressive. You know, they've different jobs, but because of their love and their passion for it, they've educated themselves on it.
Because you work for Metairn.
I do indeed. Yes.
But when you're storm chasing, that's not on.
No,
Metairn's
time. It's what you would call a busman's holiday for sure. Yeah.
Take time off to do more work.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Have you been many times?
So I've been over to the States 3 times, and. I'm actually heading over at the end of this week.
Are you going this week?
Yes, yeah.
Because it is the middle of the season.
It is, yeah. So I'm just going for a week.
I gather you don't usually notify your family in advance.
I try not to overemphasize. I usually say, I'm going over to, you know, because they know I'm interested in photography. So I'm going over for the photography side of things. And then afterwards, when I come back, I'll show them the pictures. But I'm going over on Friday. And I'll be taking lots of pictures. I'll be putting them up on my social media and things like that as well.
Great.
Well, doesn't that beat Banagher? Sligo man Noel Fitzpatrick there, professional storm chaser, talking to Oliver Callan this morning. And that's all I have for you on this wet, wet, wet edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app, and the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether smoother, nicer, chiller look back and an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.